But I said, I have the solution. I have the solution, Errol. Now, here's a funny thing. This is how it's always a poetry of synchronicity. Harold, who has no clue about the New Age, he hates it, he never understood it, he didn't do anything, he just can't understand it, or he claims he doesn't. He bumps into Jane, who channels Seth, somewhere on his walking around in his insane robotic life. Okay? So he tapes, what's her name? Jane Roberts. The famous Jane Roberts, who channeled Seth. It may be the only thing, I think you can see it on YouTube. He said, this strange lady started talking all this crazy stuff. I had my video camera way back there when people didn't have video cameras. He had one, and he taped her. So in our second matchup in September 2000, I come on and play the Evergreens, and he plays the Seth tape. You would have watched that, right? And he's there going, I don't know what this is, Bob. I don't understand any of it. It's fucking ridiculous. And I say, well, don't look, fuck, but I'll tell you what it is, Harold. And then I'll tell it to him and explain it. He'll go, I don't understand, Bob. I say, you don't make a fucking effort to understand, Harold. You just keep saying you don't understand. You're so fucking stupid. It's ridiculous how you are. He's so narrow-minded. And he says, well, Bob, it's all about that. I said, no, it isn't. It's not all about economics. And he said, it's all about economics. So the irony of it is that 9 years later, Ion shows up, an expert on Seth and Jane Roberts, and talks about them and has that whole thing and talk about them just like he can the Evergreens. In other words, Harold, it's like me and Harold, we put Evergreens and Seth together on that show. And 9 years later, the confluence of that, the third part of that antithesis of Jane versus the Evergreens becomes Ion. It's right there in the poetry of our topic.
Yeah.
Ion pops out of the interplay of the Evergreens and Seth. That's what's pretty poetic about it. And I can't get Harold to realize what we're doing.
Yeah, then when you called him last year, wasn't Ion on the line, or didn't he get a chance? Or
I told him all about Ion. I explained it in detail. Ion wasn't there. For some reason, Ion wasn't there. And I was just talking to him. And what happened is I had a long talk with Harold for like 40 minutes, and when I finished, I said, what do you think of that? And nobody's there. Everybody got cut off and missed a good chunk of it. And I thought everybody was hearing all this great dialogue. It was great nuttiness I was getting out of Harold. Nobody heard it. I guess there's a short segment of it, but not all the good stuff. And he explained a lot, but he explained a lot of what happened to him. And it really illustrated, Harold, these problems are going to happen to you as long as you ignore me. As long as you don't get right with Ion, you will have big problems. And he was expressing it all and didn't know it. And there he is, him and Mark Stallman, arguing, and Mark, and he does the same thing to Mark. He says, Mark, you're going on about media and hot and cool media. It's all about economics. Now, Stallman is an economic analyst and out of Wall Street, but Harold and him can't meet on it. Anyways, tell me some more impressions of our debate. It is two fanatics arguing against each other that are not going to budge.
Yes. The one noticeable point from the six interviews that I saw is to see how old is he?
He's born in 1935, so he's 65 in 2000. So I see him from 65 to 74, so to speak. Those nine years is when he is his age during those debates. 65 to 74.
Because it was funny to see how in each interview it seemed like his ability to talk deteriorated. His voice sounded totally different.
Yeah, it was two of them in 2000, and then it doesn't happen until 2004 when the Robin Williams movie came out, The Man of the Year, with a character named Tom Dobbs who becomes President of the United States. And it's exactly my scenario about how I won the Secret Council 10. And he doesn't get all the subtleties, but he just can't believe that it's my name in this movie. And that's why he invites me back on. And that's a good point. That's a synchrony, but I can't get him to understand that. And then I'm back in 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008 for a total. But there is a four-year gap there where he ages or gets weaker.
What's funny is because I listened to 2000, 2004, and 2006, and what's funny is that I had to go back and listen because each, the beginning, always sound the same.
Oh, yeah. He says,
how he opened up with you. Good friend. But then one time I noticed it was different because then he couldn't, he said you were a media psychiatrist and you corrected him.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, yeah, Bob is a media psychiatrist, media college. Yeah, media college. Good friend. Coming by.
Yeah. Harold never prepared. And you know how he always signs off? It's been your pleasure to hear the wisdom of Bob Dobbs. He says to the audience, it's been your pleasure. Not his pleasure. It's been your pleasure to hear. That's what he says every time. And when he tapes it, you'll see we're talking. So what he does, we talk and we get talking. And then after 2 minutes of chatting, he'll turn to the mic and goes, oh, hello, yeah. As if you've just walked into the room. He's, welcome back. Welcome here. I'm just talking here with Mark Stallman. Mark Stallman's an old friend of mine. He says that to everybody. He never sees these people. They never see anybody ever again. It's bullshit. You know, he's not their friend. I was his friend because he liked Carolyn. He would invite us to the Thanksgiving dinner. So I actually did go to his place many times in that 10-year period or 8-year period, but Mark Stallman never did. Mark's not a good friend of Harold's. He's a good friend of everybody that he has on. And, you know, it's up to like 3,000 interviews now or something. It's incredible.
Also, there was another interesting is that before the screen would come on, you would hear background like, hey, is that door open?
Yeah.
Hey, no. Is this guy ready? You know, and there's no screen, but you hear the sound, and then all of a sudden you start talking. It's like, wow, that's pretty raw TV.
Yeah, that's Harold would do
no
that.
Visual.
Yeah, I think he meant that. You know, you'd be eavesdropping, and he'd be trying to get the technician to pay attention because he always had some amateur volunteer. If you notice, Mark Stallman is spelled wrong. He was always spelling everything wrong, whoever had the shit on there, and they had me spelled wrong backwards. It was always fucked up. But Harold is basically talking constantly all his life. Every day he's taking calls, arranging. Mm-hmm. He had to do two or three of them a week back then. And not so much, I think it's only one a week or something now, but he was always, every day, had to find a new guest for his show. So he's always on the phone, talk, and he's always saying the same thing from the same position with everybody comes in, and it's very easy. Oh, okay, the people don't know who you are. Let's hear about your background. And he does get a lot of background out of people that you wouldn't normally get. In any interview, nobody gives you their history. He gets their history, and that goes on for about 20 minutes. So you find out a lot of different interesting people. You find out stuff. And so he spends a lot of time, waste time of them talking their history. And then Harold gets excited. Oh, yeah, I went to that school, or I know that person, you know, and he's just going along. And then he gets into them to talk about their position. So they get to talk about their position, say, from 22 minutes into the interview till about the 30-minute mark. So they get 8 minutes to say their bit. And then right around then, Harold says, wait a minute. If we've had 2,000 years of scarcity, now there's no more scarcity. And we're either going to wipe ourselves off the map or change. And the person wonders how that relates to what they've been talking about. Right? And it throws them. And then Harold's got them by the balls for the next 25 minutes. And Mark Stallman, you watch that one. That's the third time. He knows the game, and I've talked to Mark about it. You know, we've analyzed. You'll see, he says, fuck that. He goes, forget that, Harold. We're not talking about that Bucky Fuller shit. Mark calls him on it. Harold gets mad. He says some things back at Mark. It's almost like a club. It's a club, you know, a New York club. With these endless new people passing through. Because Harold had a huge party every December 15th, a huge Christmas party. Thousands of people would come to his big apartment and wander through. And Harold would always meet a whole bunch of new people in the party that would help him, that he'd do interviews with for the next 6 months. That's how he got new interview people. Strangers would show up because they'd heard about the party, and many people would mingle and meet there of the intellectual elite of New York on the street level, not the Henry Kissinger level or the institutional guys, but the street intellectuals would all end up at Harold's.
So, Robin, do you know Harold?
I've seen him on the television when I was in New York. Yeah.
Yeah, Manhattan Neighborhood Network
program. Manhattan Neighborhood Network. Yeah, it's the cable public access channel.
Yeah, yeah. So you've seen the Bald Harold. You've seen him.
Absolutely. I always thought he was a riot, dull as dishwater, but basically a riot. He has his shtick. It's sort of like a sitcom. It's like a sitcom. I mean, part one is this, and then you have the beginning, the middle, and the end. And he has his formula. He's formulaic.
Yeah, he's very passionate.
Passionate, but formulaic. You just put it out there.
He's actually a nut.
In 10 minutes, you explained it all. Yeah, he's a crazy man. But you know what?
I think he's having fun. Having a what?
I think he's having fun. Do you think he enjoys?
Oh yeah, he's a prankster like me. He's setting everybody up. He's a prankster. So listen to this.
He's deadpan too. He can be a very
He's very deadpan. That's right. I could make him laugh. I could get him. He loses deadpan with what I would do. But here's the thing. I get to New York in 93, so I start watching the cable late 93 and early 94. I saw him about 94, and he was more intense. He was younger and healthier and more intense and passionate.
Uh-huh.
I said, that fucking guy's a nut. I said, it's interesting how he's intense and he's intelligent, but there's something, his eyes are bulbous. He's got Sam Peku eyes. There's something off about him.
There is.
So I never watched him. Okay? Yeah. So that's 94, 95. I never watched him. 98, March 28th, 1998. I'm doing the McLuhan conference at Lincoln Center. And near the end of the day, I go up and I'm sitting up at the back and there's gradually not many people there. And I look over and I immediately recognize him. There's Harold. I recognize his fucking head. And he's standing there. And he's sitting there. He's just like me. He's watching everything and he stays the whole day and he's looking for new people to interview. So I look over at him. He sees me looking at him. He goes, what? I says, you ought to interview me. That's the first thing I say to him. He doesn't know I know him. And I reckon, I said, you ought to interview me. And he said, why? I said, I'm the most knowledgeable guy on McLuhan ever that you ever heard. And I didn't know he knew McLuhan at that point. I said, I'm the most knowledgeable guy about what you're hearing here today. And he said, well, that may be so. And he turns away and ignores me. So we say no words. That's that. 2 years later, Alan Steinfeld discovers me. And I get interviewed in their studio on April 14, 2000, and that's the day the dot-com blew up. So it's my first time on TV in New York City. It fucking changes everything. We now know why, thanks to Ion. It just was curious back then. But everything collapses. Well, Harold Channer saw that interview, and he says to Alan, who is that guy? I got to interview him. And so Harold comes over, and I get introduced to him. So we do the interview. That's the June one, the first one, where we go do a lot of McLuhan. On the first one, we might even have some footage. So he invites me to his party within a week or so to something going on into the summer, June, July. And so I go there, and I meet Giorgio Gomelsky, which was a great meeting. Giorgio Gomelsky is the guy who created the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and everything. He's the big hidden secret of rock, of British rock. But I don't want to go into that for a minute. So later, after talking to Giorgio, we hit it off and talk a long time. Harold's there talking to everybody, bopping around. And then there's this black guy. And he looks over at me, and I look at him at some point, and he says, I think we've met. And I said, I don't know. Who are you? He says, my name is Ornette Coleman. I go, holy fuck. That, you know,
oh,
Ornette Coleman's
wow.
the greatest jazz guy for many
yes.
decades, right? I go,
yeah.
I had met Ornette Coleman in 1972. And here it is 30 years later, 2000.
Wow.
He's totally changed. Like, he's thinner and older and that. And he says, Ornette Coleman. And I tell him we met. So we get together and we start talking and we start fitting his wake and have a very good conversation. So he gives me his phone number and I'm going home. Holy shit. This is incredible. Who I met through Harold. Georgia Gomelski, a big deal in rock, and Coleman, a big deal in jazz. He had a MacArthur Grant at that point. You know, the genius grant?
Okay,
He had that, and he lived in Harold's building. So a week later, I call up his phone number, and I go on and on explaining this and that, and I leave a long message, and he never calls back. And I find out about 4 days later that he smashed his hand a few days before, and he would be laid up for a year or more. He almost ruined his playing. So when I called him, he was in the hospital, and I guess I never really called back. So he was in no mood. So I never got a chance to go into details, other than in 2007 or 2008, before I moved to Hawaii, I went to his apartment and knocked on the door. First of all, you can't get into the building. So I knew Harold was not there. So I went to the building, and I looked up addresses and everything, and I found out the apartment number of Ornette Coleman was on the New York Times, you know, on the newspaper. I figured it out. So I buzzed the door, and I said, I'm here. I have a message from Harold Channer. I need to speak to Ornette Coleman. They buzzed me in. Okay. So I get up there, and you can't get in there, but I got up there. So his aide comes to the door, and I give him. It's the very thing that's highlighted today on Ed's website. The media approach to inflation article by McLuhan. That's the big thing today. I hand a copy to when the door opens, I can hear them practicing around the corner in the apartment. And so they stop, and the guy comes to the door, and I said, this Ornette should read this. And he says, okay, thank you very much. And so mission completed. I got my chance to turn Ornette on to McLuhan, which I would have done 7-8 years before if we had continued talking.
Right.
So I finished it. Because I had to give a copy to Harold, and I think I must have left him his in his mailbox or something. That was it. So I said, I got an extra one. I got to give it to Ornette. So I told the guy to tell Ornette to tell Harold about what he thought of the article. So a week later, I call Harold, and he's not heard from Ornette, and he said he'd tell Ornette, but he never did. He told me later, I can't bother that guy. I don't want to bother him. So I never found out what Ornette thought of what I gave him. So that was you could meet all kinds of interesting people at Harold's. He really was a hub, a switchboard of intellectual activity in New York. It's and yet they all respect Harold. They don't know he's a nut. He really is. You can see it. You look through closely at those things. And if you know his history.
Well, you know, they respect Harold because he comes off as being professorial. Okay,
yes.
Number one.
He wears the suit.
And, exactly. And his diction and the way he speaks, and you can think of him as being an old-time professor.
And he knows a lot about everything.
And he knows a lot. He can talk small talk about practically anything with lots of good juicy details.
Yeah.
And he knows a lot of interesting people. So people automatically are going to respect him and think that they're going to have a good time and meet some interesting people through. And it just keeps going, you know? Yeah. And the ball keeps rolling year after year.
Yeah, over the 8 years, I introduced him to a lot of people that I knew. I turned him on to a lot of people he didn't know. So it was two networks crossing.
Always, and you're just two. Think of all the other ones. It's all multiple networking.
Harold
he may be a nut, but he was brilliant at that.
Well, the people aren't observant. They don't have time. They don't watch. They didn't talk to him 10 times. They don't notice that he's repeating himself. I watched his many of his shows. I had nothing else to do in the morning. I'd watch his show, and I'd watch him interview all these people, and he did the same fucking thing in every interview. Nobody else called him on it. I was the only one to call him on it.
No, nobody cares. They've got their own stuff.
So. Yeah, they don't care. They're not learning.
No.
I'm fucking listening. I'm dangerous. I pay attention.
Yeah.
Because you're the observer. You're the observer type.
Yeah. And you can see it.
And I just sit there and I listen and I listen to everybody and then I say, oh, that's interesting. So and so did this and they're there.
Oh, you do that too? You're a listener?
Every week.
You're saying you're a listener?
I'm an observer and a listener.
Right.
And
well, you'll notice
it.
You've got to look at these interviews. You got to look because you'll see. As we by the second or third interview, 2004, I know his shtick, and he starts interviewing me with this thing, and I'm there nodding my head real violently. Yeah, that's right. And I'm grinning, ready to go. Did you notice that, Bert?
Yeah. There was one interview where you busted him. You said, Harold, the only reason I'm here is because your guest canceled, and I'm here talking to you.
In 2004, Andrew Crystal was in Ottawa at the National Archives, and he called me and he said, I've got the McLuhan, there's a McLuhan Bucky Fuller correspondence here. So I said, I got to get to Ottawa. So I eventually got to Ottawa. These are the archives I partly organized for McLuhan's widow. And I've got the correspondence and what McLuhan said about Bucky, his critique. And I came on one of the shows, and I think I read it. I don't know. Maybe you haven't got to that one yet, Bert. But I have the content of McLuhan, his rebuttal of Harold, which is... He never had that. He didn't have Bucky's rebuttal of McLuhan. So that should be in one of those interviews. I have the documents to show where and I just posted it about 2 months ago on my Facebook page, McLuhan's criticism of Bucky Fuller. I don't think Harold would understand it, but it's pretty interesting what McLuhan says about Bucky Fuller. Mm-hmm. And they were good friends, and they had a press conference in 1971. And they both talked at the same time. It was supposed to be a dialogue between them. They both chattered like two autistic people. They didn't listen to each other. They both just kept talking side by side to each other. And Robert Fulfer wrote an essay on it or an article in the newspaper. It's pretty funny. Two solipsists, two autistic guys, two great minds. Well, then me and Harold repeat that. I mean, it's many times. I don't know. You'll notice. Harold started. Harold starts saying something, and I'll go, Harold. I know that, Harold. You don't need to run through that again.
You're the great mind, yes. And he's the crazy.
Yeah. Now, when I told Harold what we were doing on that phone call a year or so ago, I pointed out for him, I blew it. You're doing that new age stuff, Bob, that stupid stuff, and he has not, I stopped getting emails from him. I think he's caught me out because I ruined my image in his mind of what I do. I tried to tell him we had the solutions. He does not believe that. He does not believe there's going to be a solution.
That's what you always said. I mean, there were a few interviews where you said you had the solution.
Yeah.
The man with the solution.
And what does he say?
Really nothing. He doesn't even acknowledge. Like,
yeah, he doesn't acknowledge what I said.
No. But, Bob, I think I remember the interview because I think when you talked about McLuhan and Bucky Fuller, Harold didn't know that they were friends. Is that correct?
Right. He didn't know they were that as connected as I knew they were.
Right. I saw that interview. Yes, I did see that one. Yes.
Yeah.
Because I remember that because he's like, they were friends? Yeah. And then you...
Yeah. The thing about Harold, he actually doesn't listen. He, what was I going to say? He, I notice he never takes anything in that somebody says. He can talk at gossip level, but he doesn't learn anything. He's never learned anything in the since he got declared insane. He's only got in a way, confided to me that's what I called him on it. We used to have private discussions. I said, Harold, you say the same thing every day. You sucker them in. You pretend you're interested in their topic, but you're not. You want to confront them with the fact that we have gone 200,000 years under scarcity, and we're not scarce anymore. And this is a big crisis for everybody's identity. And you think we're going to blow ourselves up because we can't meet the test. This is what you do to everybody. He goes, that's, he smiles. He goes, yes, that's what I do, Bob. I said, yep, you do. You're a fucking prankster. Now, then I would say, you've met your match, because I do the same thing, Harold. I've never changed one fucking inch in 30, 40 years. I've said the same fucking thing. But to my surprise, I called him up last year and said, hey, Harold, I've changed. There's something new. It worked. I actually do have the solution. And he couldn't hear it. He couldn't register on his brain. He just went on about his problems, on and on.
Yeah.
I don't remember what show it was, but you were on there with some spiritual healer.
Yeah, that was Frank. Frank had me on his show. He was a New Age guy, and he was in between me and Harold. He was a political guy like Harold. He knew the ideas, but he could accept the New Age flaky stuff, and he was that. So he was the only guy Harold knew that would tolerate mediumship, so that's why he was on when we presented the Evergreens and Seth. Frank was the, like, a protecting go-between between me and Harold, because it was, here's Harold, he tapes fucking, what's her name, he's always saying, I don't know what she's doing, I understand what you're saying, and I tell her what you're saying, she says, I don't know, I can't understand that stuff, Bob, I'm into economics. He says the same fucking thing like a same person. He'll, every time he'll say, I don't understand that stuff, Bob. I'm into economics. I think economics is the most important thing. And he says that every time, the exact same lines.
Yeah, because that one interview where we had the other, what's his name, Frank? Frank said something, and then Harold went on to this whole thing, and then that's when you start laughing. Said, are you listening? Are you listening to us?
Yes.
Are you listening to us?
Yes. Now, that was a few months later. I didn't know him that well. I probably generally said, you're not listening. I probably started to notice, you're not listening, Harold. That's probably the first time I noticed it, because it's just a few months later in September 2000, and did the first one in June. And then I don't basically interact with him for 4 years. Maybe we talk on the phone a bit, but he doesn't have me back. And it's only because it was Anachrony, the movie. He called me up. He says, Bob, there's a movie about you. How did this be? How could this possibly be? I said, I'll explain it. Yeah, okay, you interviewed me and I'll explain it. So I try to explain it, but it goes deaf. He doesn't hear it. But he does start to have me back, and things sped up after that. Things were getting, Ian was lurking. I mean, 2 years later, well, you take that Dobbs thing becomes president, that's 2004. A year later, Carolyn meets JW. A few months after that, I'm talking to JW. So I'm dealing with JW all through 2006, and I'm being interviewed by Harold in 2006. So I could, you know, I had that starting to happen to me.
ESP.
Yeah. So I basically, I think Harold's disgusting. I think anybody who can't see what's going on here with Ion, that's fucking stupid. This is the litmus test of whether you're a human being or not, or an actual intellectual or an explorer. If you can't respond to Ion, you are stupid. And no matter how much you thought you were smart.
He's not an explorer, and he's not curious.
He does think he's running a revolution, and it's based on Louis Kelso's economics. Kelso
gosh.
Is the thinker.
Oh, I remember that,
You remember Kelso?
Yes, of course. That's not some 1960s.
Yeah, McLuhan quotes Kelso. He was blown away that Kelso was in the McLuhan book. He didn't know that.
Yeah.
I mean, I was always illuminating Harold's world back to himself, telling him new things about his robotic formula. he couldn't notice it. and see, what Kelso did get legislation. He became a friend of Russell Long.
Exactly, the Keogh Act.
Maybe, I don't know what that is. Maybe that's it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just say this. Huey Long was the famous, you know, Southern politician, and his son, Russell Long, became a senator or something.
Very
and
well known. Big cheese.
Yeah, and he became a fan of Kelso. And Kelso got into Congress, and they brought in a certain kind of legislation where unions can take over factories or something. It has an acronym.
Well, it was shareholding. Shareholders.
Yeah,
they became shareholders.
It had a term. It had some kind of, you know, acronym.
It was called the KEOG. It was the KEOG Act, K-E-O-G-H.
Okay. Yeah, all right.
Mm-hmm.
And,
that
and
was
you know
the
what?
Name of the
Harold,
act.
Because Harold met Kelso in that period, he would go down and lobby on behalf of Kelso and deal with Russell Long, and Harold did have an impact with his TV show of changing the of creating the legislation.
Absolutely.
He actually did accomplish that. Right when he's being, that's in 73, right when he's being declared, you know, insane.
Exactly. That's when, that's when the steel industry went to hell in a handbasket, and all the steel workers were going crazy because Japan had taken over all the steel manufacturing.
Right.
And all the heavy manufacturing was really going down the tubes. And that's
so
when
they handed it over
started
to the
to
workers?
Get into trouble. Well, they didn't hand it over. They just got shareholdings. They were allowed to buy shares at like an inside price or given some. And I don't know really where the heck it went.
It faded out because, you know, by the Reagan era, digital economy, everything's obsolete.
Yes, it was gone. Right.
But that guy, this is what you don't know. It takes an observer like me to find this out. That guy that you're looking at on Manhattan Cable, he fucking brought in that legislation. Harold Channer was a big part of that. And you know the and the that JFK movie by Kevin, what was that? Kevin somebody plays Jim Garrison.
Kevin Costner.
Yeah, Oliver Stone's movie. Kevin Costner. Remember, Jim Garrison is a politician, attorney, district attorney or something in New Orleans. His politician is Russell Long. It's Russell Long. In the movie, Garrison intrigues Russell Long. Or Russell Long, no, Russell Long intrigues Garrison. Jim Garrison, the Kevin Costner. So the Garrison becomes the famous Garrison investigating it because of Russell Long. And Russell Long gets involved with Kelso. So this Russell Long guy, he must be an interesting person because
They named a Senate office building after him.
Oh,
Russell
is that right?
Long
in Washington?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so he and Harold's right in the middle of that. And that's basically all that Harold ever did in a practical world because, nothing else happens. But Harold always... He's still a Kelso maniac. He still talks. He has the Kelsey, those professors who are Kelso advocates. They come to his parties. They come in. He interviews them. They repeat their interviews, the same fucking formulaic interview every time. And Harold just makes them that's his solution. If we can bring in Kelso economics, everything will be cool. And he's still waiting for it. And I keep telling him, no, we got five bodies now, Harold. That's not going to happen. None of that kind of stuff will happen. Not definitely. Well, Bob, do you know that for 200,000 years we've been operating under scarcity, and we're not scarce anymore? Yes, I know that. I know it fucking was declared on your birthday, October 12, 1971. I know that, Harold. And I'll say that. I'll say his biography back to him. And he had given me the articles in the local papers, and he was set up by the local mafia. He was totally framed, but he never went and sued them. He just said, everybody, it's a post-scarcity world, no hard feelings, sorry you put me in jail, but I learned a lot, and you guys are assholes, but everything's cool. We must not create divisions anymore. He's like, in a way, he has a total hippie aesthetic. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Forgive everybody.
Yep,
love
I
everybody.
Do. Absolutely, yep.
But he doesn't look like one.
No. No, he doesn't.
No, it was the only, this is in the 90s, 92,000, there's nothing happened in America, in the United States, New York, it's being Disneyfied, it's fucking dead. The only thing on an intellectual level that's interesting is Harold's show, and I get on the show, that's my luck. I get to the center of the feeble New York intellectual world that's happening, you know? I get
it
to
was.
Be, and I'm
feeble.
The main guy, I'm interviewed the most.
Yeah. It's,
And I never tried to find him.
It was quite amazing. No.
I told him to interview me in 98. He said no, so I dropped it. And then life brought us back together 2 years later through Alan Seinfeld. So that's how magic, that's how you relax.
And he's still running his shows.
He's still doing his show, and I'm still doing mine.
Hi. Right. And he still hasn't come back. I remember your original, you know, one of your, he chatted with Ion. It's a great.
That's who I'm confusing. I'm confusing Alan Seinfeld with Harold. That's
yes,
what
that, Alan, that, no, no, Alan. Alan has done an Ion.
Balding, but he's not bald.
That's right. Now, but you did watch six Chandler things,
yes.
Not Alan Seinfeld.
Yes. No, I was confusing because I remember someone that from your New York City time spoke with Ion, and I was confusing, but it was Alan. I remember that.
Yeah,
now
he did that. We hooked up to his network, BBC Network,
yes,
or something, and BCC. Now, here's the thing. He and Harold are my two problems in New York. Alan Seinfeld meets me first. He's a heavy New Age guru connector. He sponsors panels and everything. Have you ever heard of him, aside from me? Robin?
Me?
Did you?
Yes, of course.
You knew about him. He had a long time show.
I used to watch his show, too. Yeah.
Yeah, New Realities. He had a show for years.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows everybody. Dan Winter, he stayed at Dan Winter's last year. Dan Winter is me interrogating Ion about Dan Winter, what he says about death that led to the, you know, how do you feel to be stone cold dead? That three tape series is done,
yes,
caused by Alan and Dan Winter. So I met a lot of people through Alan Steinfeld too. So this is New York's intellectual life in the 90s. It's people having a cable TV show. It's so discarnate. You know, it's not a bunch of, you know, abstract artists down in Cedar Tavern in the Village anymore. There's no Dylan.
True.
There's no folk music. There's nothing.
It's
all on the media.
No.
Andy Warhol had a show in the 80s on Manhattan Cable. So Alan and Harold go way back. So Alan becomes a connector and a go-between and a switch, a Grand Central Station, what's the other one, a telephone switchboard for the New Age world all over North America and into the world. He's the opposite of Harold. He's doing
absolutely
what Harold does not recognize.
Yes.
And Alan will not tolerate Harold's formulaic intellectuality. They're very good friends, long friends. Every New Year's, every Thanksgiving, I go to Harold's for Thanksgiving, Alan be there. So it's me, Alan, and Harold, the two factions, and Bob and Connie there. You know, the two spectrum was right there. And here it is, Chandler, from his perspective, can't absorb Ion, and neither can Steinfeld.
No.
Steinfeld can't afford it.
Right.
If we bring Ion into his Steinfeld's network, it all falls apart. Their stuff doesn't hold up compared to Ion. Ion can't afford to accept what Ion's saying. It would undermine everything that he does in New York in the New Age circuit. I mean, he circulates a lot of the whack jobs that are on Project Camelot.
No kidding. I mean, yeah. I used to watch that, and I used to tear my hair out because Carrie Cassidy, I think was her name. She promulgated that she had an MBA, big deal. Well, she didn't act like she did, because I have one, and that's no big deal.
Right.
But she went to film school, and she learned how to do film, and she has the worst production value of anybody I've ever seen. And her stuff is crap. It really is crap. And I don't know how she gets away with it. She doesn't know where to pose a camera, where to put the audio.
Because the whack jobs don't have those aesthetics.
Useless.
Yeah, because the whack jobs that listen to her are not any, they're not in the mature world. They don't notice the aesthetics, how fucked up it is. They don't know. They're just abstractly schizophrenic numbskulls.
Well, I understand that, but she is purporting and putting herself out as a professional.
Yeah, she gave a name for that. They call it wildcat interviewing.
Wildcat interviews is their specialty.
Yeah, something like that. They had some type of a nickname that they tried to call that interviewing style that she had to try to make it a cliche or something that what they did. So.
It's a sorry excuse for very bad, worse than mediocrity, imbecility.
That's right. And and the many people who recognize that say that she's funded by the CIA.
Of course.
The paranoids that watch the show and recognize the nonsense say, well, she's obviously propped up by the CIA. She's meant to be a distracting.
She's meant to be a distraction. Who's there? Who's not there? What happened? Hello. Anybody home?
Who is that?
Robin. Hi, Eliza.
Oh, you got back on?
Well, it just beeped, and I said, anybody home? And then you said, who is that? Then you spoke.
Yeah, I don't know who unmuted us.
I don't either. Oh, I raised my hand. Oh, I called back three times and pressed star 5.
Ah! Wait, that was my laptop. Okay.
Anybody home? You!
I don't know, unless it was Bill who unmuted us, or it could have been Ion.
I hear it through my computer. I hear it through my computer.
Yeah. Mute that or lower the volume.
I'm on my phone. Yeah, I'm sitting at my computer now. I'm on the phone, and then I just either mute or unmute the computer, and I hear us on the computer. A little delay. But I thought I heard Bob. What happened?
I think it just dropped. Got disconnected. Yeah.
I think so too. I do too.
But it's really strange. It's never happened to my phone like this before. I think my phone dropped about 5 times since last night.
Oh my. No, this is the first time it happened. Yeah. Well, how have you been?
Good. Okay. I wonder who unmuted us, though.
I don't know. I just pressed star 5 and raised my hand, and then all of a sudden you showed up. And we're talking on the phone. Colder than New York. I keep my weather maps on New York as well as California, and you're having a nice time. You're having good
Yeah,
weather.
I remember you asked me to tell you something about New York to make you feel better about California, and I was like, geez, okay, it's still snowing here. You're like, yes, it's still snowing. I'm like, okay, that's so good for us.
Well, we got some rain, thank you, and it's chilly. It's in the 60s, so we're freezing.
Our weather has been pretty good lately. It's been like the 70s.
Yeah, I know. Like, as I said, I have two or three cities on my weather channel thing on my iPhone. And I put them on, and I have where I am, California, and then New York. And I said, oh, this is nice. They're having a good time. I'm really happy about that. You deserve it. You had a crappy winter.
Yes, you definitely do.
Yeah. Well, welcome to spring. Welcome to springtime. You have a spring cold? Spring cough?
Just a little weird cough I've had for a while. Oh. It's not even because I'm sick or anything, because I'm not.
No.
I've just had this cough.
Oh.
But, so... What? Wonderful. You've been keeping Bob awake.
I did. I decided to pinch hit tonight and keep him going.
Yes. Good for you. I fell asleep.
No, I went through some stuff here, and I didn't have anything to contribute, so I didn't call in. And I didn't know. I just got in the mood tonight, and then I didn't see anybody for a month. So, you know, when a little bit of disequilibrium when you move, you know, and some things don't quite the way you wish they had, and you have to make adjustments, and then you just don't want to talk to anybody for a while. So.
Oh, one of those.
It's a transition phase. So I've only been here a few months. Mm-hmm. It's fine. Can't wait for summer. Summer's going to be good.
So have you been listening to the archives?
I listen to everything, yeah. I do, quite frankly. Sometimes I think I should do...